Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. We have a lot to share today, and I welcome you. Please share information with others. We just have word of mouth, and in a medium that is excluded as disinformation, everything that the truth bearers are bringing forward, then all you're getting is propaganda from the establishment. Let me show you what our information does that can empower you. The University of Montreal has a study about how vitamin K helps protect against diabetes. Canadian researchers have identified a new role for vitamin K and gamma, what is called carboxylation in beta cells, and their potentially protective role in diabetes, achieving a first in 15 years of basic research. The discovery by scientists at the University of Montreal is a welcome advance in understanding the mechanisms underlying diabetes. But of course, nothing works as well as, well, exercising, especially after you eat a meal, going out for a half-hour brisk walk, and also taking the right supplements, including chromium picolinate, and also eating low-glycemic foods, meaning those that will not spike your blood sugar, like white rice and pastas and rolls and sandwiches. In any case, in the study, which was a first of its kind, they find vitamin K maintains beta cell function. It was essential to determine which protein was targeted by the gamma carboxylation in these cells. And they were able to identify a new gamma carboxylated protein called ERGP. This is a little scientific, but just let the scientists and physicians, nurses, public health officials in the audience, and we have many, know that there's good science showing how natural supplements can enhance our overall well-being. From Nanjing University in China, an article published in the Journal of Proteome Research, nutmeg has some hidden power, helping your liver. Smelling nutmeg evokes images of, well, fall, pumpkin pies, hot apple cider. But the spice has been used for years in traditional Chinese medicine to treat gastrointestinal illnesses. Now one group of researchers found that, well, nutmeg helps other organs, specifically the liver. And according to the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, the world consumes 9,000 tons of nutmeg annually. Nutmeg is the seed of a particular tree called the Fragams tree, which is commonly found in Indonesia and has been used to treat asthma, rheumatic pain, toothaches, and infections. In the laboratory, researchers have shown that nutmeg can fight hyperlipidemia, hyperglycemia, heart tissue damage, and hepatotoxicity. That's really important. So take nutmeg if you have liver problems. That's what this is saying. From Yakult Central Institute in Japan, probiotics mitigate stress in medical students at exam time. Well, then why wouldn't it just help people who are stressed all the time? It can. So a probiotic given to medical students during the run-up to nationwide medical school examinations reduced stress among the students. The probiotic strain was Lactobacillus casei, C-A-S-E-I. That's a strain, and it relieves aspects of stress response, especially gastrointestinal dysfunction. And a lot of people hold their stress in their gut. So just take this probiotic. Again, let me tell you what it is. Lactobacillus, and then C-A-S-E-I. That's the strain you'd want to take. And it can help you, all right? It's not very difficult. Now, from Lund at University in Sweden comes a study that was done in addition to the European Congress on Obesity in Dublin and Ireland, and it's about weight gain in late teens and 20s associated with higher risk of fatal prostate cancer. So this is important. So all the men in the audience, weight gain in a man in their late teens or 20s increases their risk of dying from prostate cancer later in life. They looked at 250,000 men in Sweden and found that weight gain over the course of a man's life was associated with developing prostate cancer overall and aggressive and fatal prostate cancer in particular. one more reason when I say there's no such thing as being overweight and healthy. Now, mind you, that's not the same as saying you shouldn't continue to love yourself, you shouldn't allow yourself or others to shame you. If you're overweight, okay, let's go through a productive, non-stressful way of losing that weight. And that way, you reduce your risk of cancers, high blood pressure, damage to your heart and arteries, the endothelium, all that is reduced, and diabetes. And dementia, all that comes from being overweight. In fact, good news, this week is Eutrice Lee's final week of her protocol, and the doctor's been in three times, I believe, this week to go over final medical report and her MRIs, and she's lost nearly 90 pounds. No longer diagnosed as diabetes without any medication. Her pulse rate, or blood sugar in the morning is around 68, blood pressure normal, kidney function completely normal, no cancer found anywhere in her body, and this is according to all three separate groups of blood tests she took and three separate sets of MRIs. That's good news. And mind you, had she not gone on a diet and lifestyle modification protocol, she would still be a month out from seeing an oncologist, cardiologist, a endocrinologist, a gastroenterologist, and a neurologist. She still wouldn't have been able to see him. She would have been dead. But she's very much alive and well and happy and a lot thinner, more energy, and she can walk 6 to 8 miles a day, where before she could walk maybe 10 feet, no more mucus. So, again, lose weight the right way, the healthy way, and live a longer life. Now, and from UCLA comes a study that fructose alters genes in the brain and sabotages both learning and memory. Where do you get it? Most fructose probably comes in the form of soft drinks. Researchers presented at the annual meeting of the American College of Neuropsychopharmacology discovered that the brain responds very differently depending upon the type of sugar. Take, for example, fructose. When your brain is hit with this sugar, it excites the reward circuits in the brain, triggering a feeling of hunger whenever a food cue is present, like a television commercial for a restaurant. In contrast, when you ingest glucose, the brain reacts by promoting a feeling of satiety instead of hunger. This is published in Medical Daily, explains the three types of sugar and where they can be found in the food supply. And the fructose, the simple sugar glucose, and sucrose, avoid all these as you can. And get your fructose from eating fruit. That does not alter your genes, okay, and creates nice satiety. And finally, from Inserm Research Center in France, an article published in the Current Neurology, they ask a question, can exercise lower the risk of developing Parkinson's disease? So getting regular daily exercise by cycling, power walking, gardening, cleaning, and even participating in sports can decrease the risk of developing Parkinson's disease based upon the new science that was just out. In fact, the study found female participants who exercised the most had a 25% lower rate of Parkinson's disease when compared to those who exercised the least. The study, it's just one of many studies. There were 95,000 female participants, mostly teachers, with an average age of 49, who did not have Parkinson's disease at the start of the study. And then those who did, then they said, what was different in their lifestyle? And it was the amount of exercise. Try to get in your 10,000 steps a day. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to cut it a little short today because I have a lot of interesting clips to play for you. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. Nice to have all of you with us today. I'm finishing up the first week of a two-week protocol with anti-agers, and they've had a lot of input. They're doing terrific. And today they had a workshop that they will not be able to find the answer to what happened, but there was a phenomena that I shared with them, and I asked them, figure it out. I won't tell you more about it, but it was very exciting, very positive, and it really got all their attention about what you can do when you put your mind to the positive side of an issue rather than the negative side. When you see yourself as a winner rather than a loser. When you see yourself as in control of your life versus blaming everyone for feeling that everything has gone wrong and someone else's fault, none of your own. Well, we have, unfortunately, too many people who stay on the negative side, the dark side, though they proselytize that they're, you know, believers in something, but evidently they don't believe in themselves. So they saw an example. I won't go further than that. And next week when we finish, we're filming all this, and then you'll let them tell you what they think they saw, something remarkable that science could not explain. Anyhow, we're going to go to some clips now, and why? Because right now, there are hearings going on in Washington that were not allowed for the longest period of time, for the last 18 years. People who are powerful, Nancy Pelosi in the House, Chuck Schumer in the Senate, and then all the special interest groups that they represent and abide by, didn't allow information to come out. Now we've got information coming out, and it's contradicting things that we have been led to believe by a lot of people in power. This is about Anthony Fauci, the CDC, and the FDA conspired to lie about natural immunity. And it's a short clip, and Jimmy Dore is leading the clip, and then I'm going to give a comment on it, and I'd like you to call in and share your comments as well. I've got three major clips to share with you, actually four, and then it's your turn to talk back. 888-874-4888 is our talk back number, and let's go now to Anthony Fauci, the CDC, and the FDA. They lied about natural immunity.
So you remember when they asked Dr. Fauci about natural immunity?
And just real quickly, there was a study that came out of Israel about natural immunity. Mm-hmm. And basically the headline was that natural immunity provides a lot of protection, even better than the vaccines alone. What are people to make of that? So as we talk about vaccine mandates, I get calls all the time. People say, I've already had COVID. I'm protected, and now the study says maybe even more protected than the vaccine alone. Should they also get the vaccine? How do you make the case to them?
You know, that's a really good point, Sanjay. I don't have a really firm answer for you on that. That's something that we're going to have to discuss regarding the durability of the response. The one thing the paper from Israel didn't tell you is whether or not as high as the protection is with natural infection, what's the durability compared to the durability of a vaccine. So it is conceivable that you got infected, you're protected, but you may not be protected for an indefinite period of time. So I think that is something that we need to sit down and discuss seriously, because you very appropriately pointed out it is an issue, and there could be an argument for saying what you said.
There could be. Now I'm going to... That was from September 2021. Now I'm going to say that Dr. Sanjay Gupta Dr. Fauci is lying, and that he always knew. And well, here's what cares Kim Iverson. Remember when they had to sue to get the FDA to release the vaccine trial data? They weren't going to release the vaccine trial data for 75 years. And I wonder why that is. What did the vaccine trial data contain? It contained this.
The first bombshell in the document is that natural immunity works and Pfizer knows it. The clinical trial data showed those with previous infection of COVID had no difference in outcome than those vaccinated. In the limited trial, none of the vaccinated nor those with previous infection resulted in severe disease defined by either the FDA or the CDC. They were broken up into two different groups. The FDA and the CDC define severe COVID slightly differently. The CDC roughly defines it as anyone needing hospitalization, whereas the FDA defines it as anyone needing supplemental oxygen. Either way, there were zero cases of severe COVID in the natural immunity group, whether they were vaccinated or not. And their own data also showed that natural immunity was statistically identical to the vaccine against infection. That's what their data showed. Yet, rather than say people with natural immunity don't seem to need the vaccine, which is what they've been saying in Europe, for example, Pfizer instead spun their conclusion and said, quote, final efficacy results show that the vaccine provided protection against COVID-19 in participants with or without evidence of prior infection with SARS-CoV-2.
So why do I tell you that? Well, because there's a new article out about when they all got together and decided to say this. So, inside the secret government meetings on COVID-19 and natural immunity, this is an article from February 2nd of this year. Four of the highest ranking U.S. health officials, including Dr. Fauci, met in secret to discuss whether or not natural immune people should be exempt from getting COVID-19 vaccines. The officials brought in four outside experts to discuss whether the protection gained after recovering from COVID-19, known as natural immunity, a thing your body's done since the beginning of time, should count as one or more vaccine doses. There was interest in several people in the administration in hearing basically the opinions of four immunologists in terms of what we thought about natural infection as contributing to protection against moderate to severe illness, and to what extent that should influence dosing. Who said that? Dr. Paul Offit, one of the experts. So he's saying that they really only wanted to hear from four immunologists. And what do you think all those four people thought alike? You think they all were telling the big pharma line? Yes, but it gets more interesting. The discussion did not lead to a change in U.S. vaccination policy, which has never acknowledged post-infection protection. It's never acknowledged natural immunity. That's what they're saying. Fauci and the other U.S. officials who heard from the experts have repeatedly downplayed that natural protection, claiming that it is inferior to vaccine-bestowed immunity. Most studies on the subject indicate the opposite, and they always have. The meeting held in October 2021 was briefly discussed before on a podcast. I'm talking about natural immunity.
Okay, let me put this in perspective so it makes more sense with a different context. Let's go back to some of my very first statements where I said that with all these infectious diseases, once you get them, like once you get measles, chickenpox, etc., then you're pretty much immune for life. In fact, we used to have, where I grew up, we had chickenpox parties. The moment someone in the neighborhood got chickenpox, everybody went over and spent the evening there, and we all came down with chickenpox. We got over it, and now we had natural immunity. And as I said at that time, let's do the smart thing. Let's have everyone in America, hopefully everyone in the world, begin to build up their immune system. The stronger your natural immunity, meaning what your innate immune system, what we all have, that protects us each day, why not build it up with zinc and also vitamin D3 and vitamin K and vitamin C and quercetin, even some herbs like astragalus, echinacea, podiarco. And that was all supported based upon the Library of Medicine's peer-reviewed journals. In fact, when scientists said, well, that's all hokum, you know, it's not science. Oh, yes. Thousands and thousands and thousands of studies are there in the Library of Medicine, peer-reviewed, orthodox science, respected institutions, showing that natural supplements play a tremendously important role in the functioning of our body and immune systems, allowing us to live a longer life, not have deficiencies. So even if we're all equally infected, we won't all have equal outcomes. And they were making it seem like anybody who got infected, anyone who tested positive on an antibody test, would ultimately get into hospital and possibly need their therapies. Well, that wasn't true. Only one group, elderlies with comorbidities, but elderly people who did not have comorbidities, when they would get sick and they built up their immune system, they would overcome this. In the vast, vast, vast majority of cases, they didn't even have a 1% death rate, not even 1%. And the rest of the population up to the age of 70 with no comorbidities had a zero chance of dying from this. So from the very beginning, we were lied to. Why? Because if you solve the fallacy of the PCR test, polymerase chain reaction test, that was invented by a professional friend of mine, Dr. Kerry Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize in science for that, he said repeatedly that at low amplifications, like at 13 or 14, you're really seeing something. But at high amplification, like 40, and that's what you all got. Everyone in the world got 40 amplifications. It was all junk. There was no legitimacy to that whatsoever. Now, fortunately, I'd done an hour and 54-minute interview, and it went viral all over the world. Documentarians were putting clips of that interview of Kerry Mullis, me interviewing him out in California at his home, into their documentaries to support that the PCR test was a fraud at the amplifications. At real amplifications, it's a tool. It's a valuable tool. Now, the New York Times started saying that if you test positive, then you are a case. But that wasn't true either. Completely wrong. So then everybody thought they were going to die, and that allowed them to believe that only by quarantining could they save their life. But not to do any medicines. But some doctors resisted and started treating their patients early, and good for them. They were on the right side. Those who believed in Anthony Fauci, that was the wrong side, and those people got sick, went to the hospital, and died. And I'm going to play you a clip in a little bit about the... maybe not today. I don't think we'll have time. But certainly $10 billion was spent by the federal government to get all these celebrities to promote vaccination. And they did, and very successfully so. They're very engaging little short promotional clips. You know, there's a lottery. You could win $5 million if you get vaccinated, and then you get into the lottery, and or you get a free hamburger, and there's the Mayor de Blasio eating a hamburger, yum, 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 and... you know, you get a donut, all these stupid incentives, and not realizing your life is in the balance with nothing in science to prove that this will work. Nothing. So anyhow, I suggested the best thing that could happen to people is that they get infected, stay healthy, overcome it, and then you would have natural immunity. Now, this is where Fauci is wrong, and he knew he was wrong. There were, at that time, at least 70 papers in the peer-reviewed literature showing that natural immunity, meaning getting sick, we didn't have a vaccine then, getting sick and overcoming it, that could last. Now, we didn't know how long it would last. Now we do know. Up to this moment, they've said 16 years. Wow. And if you get reinfected with one of the variants, less likely to be severe. Wow, wow. So if you got the virus and you got sick and now you have natural immunity, you have immunity that will at least last 16 years. What kind of immunity does the vaccine give you? Well, each one that you get lowers that efficacy. 3 months, then 2 months, then 1 month. And now what they want to do is just give you more of the boosters. But with each booster, you have a greater likelihood of going to the hospital, getting sick, and dying. That's not speculation. That's not guessing. That's in the peer-reviewed literature. Now we have all these studies. And guess how many studies there are? I have found at least 180 studies, quality studies, showing natural immunity far superior than vaccination. So why aren't we doing the smart thing and working with people who are at risk, comorbidities and elderly, with their emphysema and dementia and Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and heart disease and stroke and diabetes, and obesity is number one, by the way, a vulnerability. And why don't we help them with those conditions, reduce those conditions with a national Marshall Program to get healthy? But we haven't done a single thing. To the contrary, we tell people, just stay at home. That's it. That was all wrong information. That was my intent. So Fauci and Dr. Gobbledygook on Anderson on CNN, and I heard their ratings last week were like 300,000 people in the whole country watching them at any given time. Whoa. You know, the radio shows that have far larger audiences. In any case, they were wrong. Because if he was honest, he would have said, well, we thought that the vaccine would confer long-term safety, but it didn't. And we also thought that the vaccine would prevent you from infecting other people. That's why we had you have to take a vaccine before you got on an airplane or a cruise ship or travel. But it didn't. In fact, gee whiz, recently at the European Union, when one of Pfizer's own top executives and one of the presidents of divisions had to acknowledge that they never tested for transmission. Never. They were lying about everything. Misinformation galore. And then it didn't prevent you from getting to the hospital, even if you got it, and it didn't prevent you from being infected, and it didn't prevent you from dying. So lie about transmitting, lie about personal infection, lie about seriousness, and lying about death. So 90% of the people or more today who are dying are the fully vaccinated. And yet what are they doing? They want to mandate the vaccine in certain states, like New York State. New York is becoming Yugoslavia in the 1950s, completely totalitarian. Wow. So they lied about everything. So natural immunity and then enhancing your immune system on top of natural immunity by taking vitamin C and D3, that's the ticket. So that's the truth of that. So Fauci lied, and the networks lied. The CDC can only lie. I've never heard them tell the truth, and the FDA has been captured by special interest groups long ago. Let's go to the next clip. Now, this is interesting because this is to Dr. Dolores Cahill, C-A-H-I-L. She's got a PhD and a graduate in immunology. She has been a top scientist with the European Union as an advisor to the Irish government as advisor. She's been a professor. She's got a long and distinguished career. And here she is having a conversation about why coronavirus lockdowns killed more people than it saved. It's a short clip, but also what it means to be right and suddenly everyone in the scientific community, medical community, and the media attack you and call you wrong and an alarmist because you weren't buying the false information. This is a very interesting discussion she has here. Let's listen to it, please.
That's right, Dolores. Since you've been in the science community, you know there's a tendency in science and research and academia to kind of push unpopular ideas kind of away or down below the surface. And so when this came out with coronavirus, you had been used to this kind of behavior and you said, not this time, I need to talk about it. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. So I suppose I invented or co-invented with my team high content protein arrays back in 1996, 97. And one of the first applications of that was to look at antibodies that were used in research. And antibodies are used in diagnostic tests to diagnose disease, and sometimes quite serious diseases like autoimmune diseases and cancer. So when we applied our technology, we were screening thousands more proteins. We were getting very good results. But when we were telling the scientific collaborators that no, what you've published is incorrect, there was a lot of reluctance within the scientific community to actually correct the record, which they could have easily done because this was a new technology. So that brought me in for 20 years around research integrity and how a lot of the publications in science may not be true, and that I have been on volunteering and unpaid on the Government Advisory Science Council and in the EU to try and move towards validation of science results, and that careers should be promoted based on people putting their results and data and antibodies into open repositories so that other people can check the data. And this would enrich science. And because there's been a lot of reluctance from the funding agencies and the governments, a lot of the scientific papers are based on tools and research that are not true. And actually, I've been considering getting out of science. And that's, I think, why a lot of the clinical trials are failing, because a lot of the tools and a lot of the publications are not validated and may be incorrect. So I was able to then look at what was going on in the coronavirus, and the whole narrative is false. And maybe just for the few people who might stay for the first 15 minutes, I would like to say to them, it is very confusing. They are getting conflicting messages from eminent scientists. But from my perspective, I'm saying we don't need the lockdown. We don't need masks. We don't need social distancing. Eat well, boost your immune system. There are preventative measures, and talk to your doctors to get early and effective treatments like hydroxychloroquine and zinc. And we can re-engage in the world within a week. There is no need for the lockdown, no need for any of these new societal changes. Businesses, tourist industry, schools can open and we can go back to work.
And so the question people will ask right away is, then how did we get here? How did we get into this mess with, you know, apparently intelligent people at the helm? You know, how do we get to this crazy lockdown environment, to this these figures around the world of 6 million cases and hundreds of thousands of deaths, apparently because of COVID-19? How did it happen?
So I suppose that's why the carbon dioxide climate change debate is actually very interesting, because what happens is now that you have scientific areas emerging which are not challenged and based on false premises. And then funding agencies, you know, start a funding application with, for example, carbon dioxide is the biggest driver of climate change, which it isn't. And so if you, a lot of the money is funded into an area, and if you don't agree with that premise and write a grant with that premise, you won't get funding, and then you won't get publications, and you won't get a promotion. So what's going on now, and why we're here, is a lot of the governments worldwide do not have scientific advisors that are actually where they challenge each other. So what I'm saying as a lesson from the lockdown is we need to have open debates with, you know, representation on public forum like the BBC or Channel 4, where before you would have a lockdown, you would give, you know, equal time to various scientists with different opinions, and then that the governments would be informed for the pros and cons of the lockdown and why some of the data that the lockdown is built on, it came out very quickly that it was incorrect. And so what questions need to be asked is, why didn't they stop the lockdown weeks ago?
Now, you had coronavirus. You're probably one of the few people I've had on the show that's actually gone through it. It feels like that's relevant. Can you tell us about that experience and what we can learn from it?
Well, my husband went to America through Heathrow in December and in January, and he had a very severe cough, and he's asthmatic. So it was unusual symptoms of breathlessness towards the end. And I got it in January and February. So it was a very severe cough. And I've had pneumonia before, but it was actually a dry cough. And I became breathless for a few days at the end. And then I recovered. I was fine. Of course, if I had known now, I would have supplemented myself with vitamin D, C and zinc and rested more. But it, you know, it was severe. But it turns out now we know there are preventions and treatments so that actually you wouldn't actually need to have the symptoms. And maybe it's good to say that about half or 60% or 70% of people that will come across the coronavirus will have no symptoms at all.
Okay, and now that...
Okay. Mind you, she is saying that in good science, legitimate science, you should bring people with different points of view together and see what their perspective is on every aspect of a disease or its prevention. Nothing in the United States was promoting looking at the immunological consequences and building up a person's immune system, getting them healthy on a regular basis. To the contrary, the government could have had a daily show on television showing a health person, whether it's an exercise person, exercising in your home or outside, because there was no science that when you're outside in the sunlight, you're going to get infected. It was especially true for children. And yet the children had to go through lockdowns and wearing masks. People were even wearing masks, and their children wearing masks at home. That's how absurd it got. They could have had programs on juicing and modified fasting and the importance of these nutrients and herbs. They did none of the above. They could have programs on de-stressing to help people who are in a stressful situation because of the consequences of this, including the loss of jobs or businesses closing down. So you knew the game was rigged when there was not a single penny spent or any effort to try to help people with building up their natural immune system, making their environment where they're living, an apartment or a house, something that they could work with instead of being a prisoner of. So, you know, it was all in wait for the vaccine, get the vaccine, and even telling people who had natural immunity or already been infected, get the vaccine, get more of them. And that actually hurt those people because it can create an autoimmune condition. In fact, when the government and these idiots on television were telling people, oh, get your vaccine and making it sound sexy and making it seem trying to shame you if you didn't, well, they obviously have no knowledge of what happens when you already have an autoimmune condition, which most Americans do, or at least one-third do. According to our research, over 130 million Americans, where your immune system is already on fire. And now you bring in a vaccine that will then cause the body to create all of these spike proteins, and then that creates another alarm that goes off, and that can literally collapse organs and kill a person, and did. So everything they did was wrong, and that's why they all should be held accountable in a modern Nuremberg court of crimes against humanity. Now I'm going to play one more, and this is completely different. This is They're After Your Kids, The Real Agenda Behind the Great Reset, a conversation with Catherine Austin Fitz. And I agree with some of what Catherine has said in the past, and I disagree. I take a different point of view on some. But it's worth listening to what she has to say about the banking system, because she has worked in the bank. She was on Wall Street. She had a top position there. She was in the government. And so she comes with some scholarship and authority, at least on some issues. And she's being interviewed by Kim Iverson. And Kim does her homework. She does a good show. I highly recommend that you tune into her. Now, this is different. It's going to be a little longer, but you're going to hear them discuss things that you may not be aware is affecting you or will impact you, especially when she talks about how many tens of thousands of banks we had at one time, not long ago, and now we only have about 4,500, more or less, and half those are going to close shortly. And they're trying to get it down where there's just a handful of banks and everything goes to the digital currency where they control everything and then they own everything. They'll own your car. They'll own your house. They'll control every part of your life. That's not an imagination because they're also using artificial intelligence. The same people who are buying the banking system, who own the banks, own the stock in the banks, are the same people who own the AI industry, you know, and so they're controlling it all. So they want you under 100% control. And for a lot of people, they're unaware of this. You can't solve a problem if you're not aware it exists. Let's go to this clip, please.
Similarly, nonetheless, she says our children are being targeted, and there's a great effort to control not only our money and actions, but the size of the population. More people means it's difficult to control people, right? The more you've got, the harder it is. So we're about to have a very fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for watching. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Hey, Kim, it's great to be on. I've watched your show many times, but this is my maiden voyage. I've never been on before, so thank you for having me.
Oh, well, that's great to hear. I wasn't sure when I reached out to you. I was like, I don't know if she knows this show at all, but I'm going to try to get her. And, you know, yeah. You were actually difficult. You're difficult to hunt down and to get. You're very off the grid, which is good, probably. Really excited to chat with you. I've been following your work for a really long time and been really wanting to get you on the show to talk. We've got a lot to talk about because things seem to be, with the economy in disarray, the dollar, we've got countries dropping the dollar. We've got the Fed clearly looking to roll out CBDCs and more control over our money. And that's all very scary. And I've been saying on this show for the last few weeks, ever since the banks began collapsing, that, you know, once they can control your money, they can control you. That is,
right.
It's the most important thing, yeah, unfortunately.
So part of squeezing the middle class out has been consolidating the banks. So starting in about 1980, when the centralization began, bank consolidation, we went, I think, from 13,000 banks in the United States to now there are about 4,700. So bank I would not say that we have bank collapses as opposed to the banks are being collapsed.
Seems like a concerted effort. What do you make of the recent?
There was a concerted effort. Yeah, it's complicated. There was a concerted effort to balloon and then to consolidate. So part of this was the ballooning that happened during the pandemic because the Fed injected massive amounts of money directly into the economy. It's all part of what's called the going direct reset, which is a plan the Fed and the G7 central banks agreed to in August 2019. So if you go back to, you know, go back through history to 1998, something started, which I call a financial coup. And when you have a financial coup of the kind we had, at some point, you have to reset. So you shift a huge amount of money out of the systems that have the liabilities. So the liabilities, for example, the retirement liabilities are left inside the existing systems, but you've moved the assets out. And so a time is coming when people are expecting all sorts of promises to be kept, and you're going to have to not keep them, whether you do it through inflation or canceling contracts or political change, whatever. You know, we see the big hullabaloo in France with Macron changing the retirement age now that everybody's ready to retire. So So we're coming into the going direct reset is the reset that consolidates us, the coup. And what's been happening, Kim, is for many decades, we've been building digital systems that help us to affect central control. And those changes have been happening behind the scenes. And now they're coming out of the closet and they're becoming very brazen. So we're in the, so to speak, in the end game, if you will, on the financial reset. And everywhere you turn, you're seeing more and more central control. So consolidation of the banks, censorship, you know, cutting of food stamps, cutting of all sorts of benefits, changing retirement ages. So this is just a reset that's being rolled out in all the different aspects of life, and the effort is to centrally control.
When do you think this plan was concocted, and who are the players at this point who are implementing this plan, and are they doing it knowingly?
So you heard the establishment start to talk about it in 1980. So George W. Bush was always quoted as George H.W. Bush is moving the money into tighter and righter hands. But the big change, in my opinion, came in 1995, which was later described to me by the largest pension fund leader in the country. He said they've given up on the country. They're moving all the money out starting in the fall. And that happened. He said that to me in the spring of 1997, referring to the budget deal collapse in 1995. I think what happened is the people who run the financial system decided, okay, the current governance structure in the United States is unworkable. And so we're just going to give up on the system. You know, every effort to come up with a financially reliable plan for the future has failed. So we're just going to centralize control, steal all the assets, and then, you know, down the road, we're going to have to reset. And from 1998 on, we've seen $21 trillion go missing from the U.S. government that we know of, from government documents. So that financial coup has been ongoing for many, many years. But now that people are ready to retire and retirements are accelerating, you have to say, okay, well, you know something, all these promises we made, we're not going to keep them.
I'm just wondering, was there a group of people that were sitting in a smoke-filled room and they were having this conversation of how are we going to implement this thing over decades? And, you know, who's the mastermind behind this if it started in the 80s or the late 90s?
So let's just start with the failure of the budget deal in 1995. From then on, if you look at all the policies that rolled out, those policies were designed to lower life expectancy. One, to move the money out of the government, and two, to lower life expectancy. And they have been happening very steadily. And if you look at the budgets of the federal government and the financial statements to the extent that they're available, you know, that has steadily happened, you know, brick by brick all the way along. So this has been ongoing, and most people have felt, you know, that they weren't particularly focused on it as long as their check kept going. So as long as I'm getting my income, as the system is working for me, I don't worry about the fact that the financials of the system are not on solid ground.
Yeah. Are they that callous that they would say, oh, people are living too long and sucking too much Social Security out of the government, or we're having to support people for too long, we need to really shorten their life expectancies? Do they have those types of conversations, you think?
Yes, of course. So here's the thing. If every year for many years you try and put the financial system on a sound footing if you just look at what you're doing through the U.S. Treasury, if you try and put the tax revenues on a sound expenditure footing, and politically it is impossible year after year, because remember, there's no popular support for financial responsibility, or there has been none. Mm-hmm. So if you can't get the system to agree to a financially responsible solution, then you have only one other choice, and that's to lower life expectancy or abrogate promises. Now, you can abrogate the promises by changing the retirement age, or simply, you know, reducing the, you know, try and tear up the obligations. So we've seen, for example, different corporations go into bankruptcy so they can strip out and cancel the pension fund obligations, and then they come back out of bankruptcy. So you can abrogate the agreements, you can, mm-hmm. or you can lower life expectancy, those are your only two choices. It's pure math.
So who is mostly in charge of this? Would you say, is it like the president of the United States and the cabinet? Is it the Federal Reserve? Are they sitting around and saying, these are the things that we need to do? Who gets let into these types of conversations?
So in my experience, what happens is you have a group of different people who are part of building consensus about different policies. They are outside of the government, and there are different venues where they meet and discuss these things. So you meet and discuss these things at the Bilderbergers. You meet and discuss these things at Trilateral. You meet and discuss these things at the Council on Foreign Relations. You meet and discuss these things at the Bohemian Grove. You meet and discuss these things at the Atlantic Council. All the central bankers, when they meet once a month, you know, and when they meet at Jackson Hole, they all discuss these things. And what happens over long periods of time is that consensus forms. It's very much a committee system, and it's very much by consensus. And one of the reasons, so for example, when I was on Wall Street or in Washington, most of the big decisions about the federal budget were made at the Bohemian Grove. So you would have the appropriation committees roll out the appropriations and vote them out in the summer. Then the Congress would recess. All the big decisions would go to the Grove. Those decisions would be made at the end of July and beginning of August. You know, we're going to nationalize Fannie Mae, perfect example. And then you roll it back to the staffers who work through September so that the Congress comes back, say, in the second week in September, and then votes for the budget. And the federal finances are highly centralized, and most counties in America, the 3,100 counties, work off of the federal budget. So a tremendous amount of the money is rolled through the central bank or the U.S. Treasury, one way or the other. And so a lot of the big decisions can be centralized and then implemented through the federal budget. And if you've watched central banking policy and the fiscal policy all along for the last 20 years, I mean, we knew this reset was coming. It was just a matter of time. It's pure math. So I'll give you a perfect example. The budget deal in 1995 crashed and sort of burnt with very hard feelings in October 1995. The next month, you saw the predatory lending in poor neighborhoods skyrocket, and the FDA approve OxyContin, and the pill mills begin. And the pill mills and the predatory lending targeted the same neighborhoods. So both of those neighborhoods were under both a health war and a financial war, and were being hit at the same time.
How many banks do you think, so if they're doing this big concerted effort now to consolidate the banking in order to get the money in the hands of just a few, the control of the money, how many banks will be left standing when they're finished with this?
Well, if you implement CBDCs and allow that system to be tested out and grow, ultimately you only need one. Now, that doesn't mean that they will leave one. I'm assuming, right, Let's say you rolled out CBDCs, you'd want a network of banks to do your tech and customer support. If you're the central bank, you don't want to handle the retail, you know, dealing with the retail customer, particularly before you get the bugs out of the system. But make no mistake about it, at some point you can literally go to one bank.
So all of these other banks that are around end up just becoming retail servicers. They're not really truly banks in the sense that a bank would be a bank at that point.
Right. And remember, this is not zero or one. We don't go from a world of many, many banks who are serving their customers to a CBDC. What you're watching is more and more invasive digital controls and surveillance being foisted on the banking system and going into the banking system and into the cloud that is moving us. The train tracks of control are being built into the digital systems now and have been for 20 years. So, you know, I just was down in Tennessee and one of my allies said, I just got a credit card with two pages of instructions on things I'm not allowed to purchase with this credit card. Yeah, so all these controls have been going in. You have banks adopting software and being pressured to adopt software that identifies all of our different purchases in ways so that you could institute a social credit system or, you know, a net zero climate change system, or both.
Let's talk about where the economy is headed right now and the de-dollarization that's going on around the world. This, I think, would spell doom for, I guess I could kind of understand the panic from the people in charge when they're seeing that these countries around the globe are starting to de-dollarize. I could understand that there would be a panic because, if we have massive inflation here in the United States, that could be absolutely devastating, not just to the economy, but to the population. I mean, people die in situations like that. Inflation would be devastating. We'd turn into Venezuela or Argentina, or, you know, we'd have some serious consequences with that. So
I can understand. If you have CBDC or equivalent digital controls, you can stop all inflation by just reducing the majority of the population to poverty. In other words, for example, 2 years ago, the Biden administration recommended a person to be control of the currency to run the banking system at Treasury. And she had just published an article in the Vanderbilt Law Review about CBDCs. And she described the beauty of CBDCs is if you're worried about inflation, you can just freeze everybody's bank accounts.
Yeah, okay. So is this why they are giving us some, you know, these slogans like you will own nothing and you will be happy? Because owning nothing means you're in poverty at that. Right? You own nothing.
Well, owning nothing means that the control of all the assets you live with and use is controlled by somebody else. So, you know, I constantly say this is a slavery system. It's not a financial system. So a CBDC is not a currency. It's a control mechanism. You know, a currency is something that's liquid that you can transfer, that you can transact. This is absolutely a digital control system. And, you know, it's hard for anybody who's lived and enjoyed freedom to believe that anybody would want to do this. So sometimes, you know, well, I worry. I see your face when I say these things. And,
you know, I think, though, if people just study history, I mean, humans, for whatever reason, have a propensity to become, you know, to desire to become kings. And we've had a history of kings, you know, and these are not actual, you know, when you think of the concept of a king, like who decided one day I'm going to be king, like as if I'm closer to God than the next person. Right. You know, this is just a human being like anybody else, but they anoint themselves monarchies. And we have, and much of the world for a long time was ruled by these various different monarchies around the world. Right. And so there's dictators or there's pharaohs, or, you know, there does seem to be a natural inclination with humans throughout history to rise to the top and control everybody and have just a bunch of, you know, a bunch of subjects that you, and you are in charge of everything in their lives. So it's really, you know, I know it's for a lot of people, these types of things sound crazy that, oh, there's this control and they're going to make it to where we own nothing and we'll be happy. But it's really not that crazy when you start reading history books. It's been the majority of the time of the world's existence that it's been that way.
Well, if you look at the last time we canceled slavery, so when we outlawed the African slave trade, there were two things, in my opinion, that caused us to cancel slavery.
Okay, that was Catherine Austin Fitz and Kim Iverson. I would hold that she is accurate when it comes to the banking system and those who want to control that banking system. I would disagree with her that the object of their exercise is to reduce the population. I do not believe that may be a consequence because of dire poverty. People become depressed, they commit suicide, they take medical drugs. And that's why we have a whole lot of youth dying prematurely. But that's not because they want these. There's nothing that can prove, thus far that I've seen, that there's an intent to cause young people and the population to shrink. But they do control the dollar, but now the dollar is being challenged, and the one thing that may upset their plans is if in the next 12 months the BRICS nations Russia and India and China and South Africa, and now Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Argentina, all these countries around the world in Africa, they're joining BRICS. And that means their gross domestic product will become a part of theirs, and that will dwarf the United States. and the dollar is already under siege, and they're de-dollarizing. The rest of the world doesn't want the dollar anymore as the reserve currency. Now, it'll still exist, and it won't go to zero, but no one knows how bad the hit will be, but it could be 30%. And you'll see Wall Street, everything involving equities and assets tied to the dollar, they're going to just drop dead. You're going to see huge, huge losses in 401ks, retirement funds, and then you're going to see a whole new class of poor people in the United States. That they are working on. They're actually wanting to control all of your currency. And Kim is right. They've already said, you know, they've said, you will own nothing and you'll be happy. No, we will not be happy. And no, you're not going to take what we own. And a lot of people are going to stand up and fight back on that, not only here, but around the world. Now, you can call in and share your thoughts, 888-874-4888. I'm merely playing programs to show you all the different issues that are happening simultaneously and pretty much by the same group of people. They control the dollar, they control the exchange, they control the price of commodities, they own cargo, they own the insurance companies, they own the hospital associations, they own the pharmaceutical companies, because they own controlling interest. And they are not nice people. They don't have our best interest at stake. If they did, then why are we ghettoizing countries and America in particular? You know, that said, I do have a good special for you today. I'd like to share. We've been out of a particular product for some time because it was very hard to get the all-natural ingredients, and this is our eye care tablets. Well, we just got them back in today. So the good news is if you care about your eyes, you'll care about this product. And also, you're going to get a book. And I haven't been able to get my hands on this book for a long time, but now I do. I bought out the publisher. I didn't buy the publishing company. I bought all my books. And this is one of the most single important books I've ever written, Get Healthy Now. It's a huge book. It really covers everything you need to be healthy. And that book is now available. And also the award-winning documentary, The Biological Aging Challenge. And everything that I'm doing with these people here is in there. You'll see all these people and the great results they got after the first five. Now we're in number six, and we're filming it as well. So you're going to get how to slow down and reverse the disease and aging process and add years to your life. You're going to have all the information you need at your fingertips on Get Healthy Now, a massive book. And you're also going to get your eye care tablets. All this would normally cost you $105. Today, it's only $39.99. That's a huge difference. You're going to save $64.94. That's a huge savings, over 60%. How do you get it? It's simple. I'm going to give you a number to call. Call this number and get your special. Get the book, get the documentary, and get the eye care product. All right? Call this number, 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Again, that product's been out for 3 months. We got it back in. And we're ordering as much of a product as we can so we're not out of anything for the next 3 years. That's the goal. Because when I tell you that there's all kinds of shortages out there in the world, I mean huge shortages of food and equipment and taking forever to get to you and accelerated prices. I did not increase my price on any of this. Or you can call Neil in the Vitamin Closet, Monday to Saturday, noon to 8, at 646-926-5430, 646-926-5430. Or you can just go online and order it for yourself. So we've given you a lot of information on a lot of different topics just to show you, pull back, go to neutral, and look at what's happening, and you can only make positive choices if you know what's coming at you. And so I'm giving you the larger picture, not to depress you, not to make you fearful, but rather to enlighten you that we've got to pay attention to these things. We've got to do it together, and we will. A lot of people are making changes in their life now, and that's a good thing. I'm told we don't have time to take calls today, so we're going to go right over to you, Therese Lee, who's standing by. Remember, share this information with other people. You know, and it's no secret. They're all over the world, they're de-dollarizing. So why wouldn't you pay attention to that and get out of dollars? buy things that you can use for the future now before they de-dollarize, and suddenly everything costs you a lot more. Okay? I have a lot of good stuff lined up for our next program next week, and I look forward to sharing that with you. Have a nice weekend, everyone. And remember, call 877-627-5065, because everybody should have healthier eyes. And this is just my contribution to that, plus the book that you'll use forever, Get Healthy Now, and the documentary that can show you what I've been doing over the last 4 years with all these individuals and helping them reverse their aging process, which we've proved scientifically. In fact, today I got notice that it was accepted for peer review publication. Good. All right? And we're on and forward. Have a nice day, everyone.